This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And the Charleston Gilliard Center, presenting in partnership with Buxton Books, a conversation with author Eric Larson on the launch of his new book, The Demon of Unrest, Thursday, May 16th. More information at gilliardcenter.org.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with David Nicholson about his book, The Garretts of Columbia, A Black South Carolina Family from Slavery to the Dawn
David,
of Integration.
David, it is a delight to have
In
you
his
on
book,
the journal
David
today
tells
for
a multi-generational story of hope
the story
and resilience.
Of your family is
the Garretts of Columbia is an American history of
state
black
and local
struggle,
history,
sacrifice,
and
achievement.
Spend a lot of time in the local history
At the heart of the story are David
Library,
Nicholson's great-grandparents, Casper George Garrett, and his wife, Anna Maria. Papa, as Garrett was known to his family, was a professor
really
at Allen University, a lawyer, and an editor of three
and
newspapers.
And the local stories are frankly a lot
Dubbed
more interesting
Black South
than
Carolina's most respected disliked man,
but I wouldn't
he was always ready
you know,
to attack those he believed disloyal to his race.
The impact that it has.
Well, I would agree, but in looking at the local like you did, you shed light on the larger scene as well.
Thank you. I think I do.
In your introduction, you said you started this book 60 years ago.
Yes, and that is kind of a literary conceit. It's a way of talking about something that happened years before I actually began to write the book. And, you know, to say that the book is about things that I wish I had known 60 years before.
And so when did you first find out the family background, because you really focus in on your great-grandparents. You call them Papa and Mama.
Right. Papa was Casper George Garrett, most often known as C.G. Garrett in his lifetime, and his wife, Anna Maria Garrett. I wanted to write the book, and the book is dedicated to my son and to my nieces, and it's dedicated to them because I wanted them to know stories I wish I had known when I was growing up. I began to hear the stories of Mama and Papa when I was in my late 20s or early 30s, and I was intrigued by them, though I didn't actually start doing the research for another 15 or 20 years. But their stories are the kind of inspirational stories that I wish I'd heard when I was younger, and that I hope are going to inspire my son and my nieces.
Well, let's talk about the folks you call Papa and Mama. I was familiar, or at least I knew the name of Papa because of his ties to Allen University here in Columbia, and also
right.
his arch nemesis, the good bishop, or maybe the not-so-good bishop. So why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
About Papa?
Yes.
Well, he, as I look back on his life, I am really amazed. He was born in 1865. There are two other accounts of when he was born, but I'm going to stick for right now with 1865. And simply by an accident of birth, escaped being born in slavery. He was born several months after the end of the Civil War. And 25 years later, he had finished normal school at Allen University. He had gotten a bachelor's degree from Allen, and he had gotten a law degree from Allen. And he had been admitted by the South Carolina Supreme Court to argue in any court in the state. And as I look back on that, that's an amazing trajectory. In 25 years to have gone from almost slavery to three college degrees and, you know, to be able to practice as a lawyer in the state of South Carolina.
And actually, since that's post-Reconstruction South Carolina, he was admitted to the bar is an important fact in itself.
Yes, and it's also worth noting that he did not practice. He seems to have opened a law office for a year or two, but most of his income, such as it was, came from teaching at Allen. And, you know, the unfortunate truth is that if you were a Black person in need of a lawyer, you probably were going to maximize your chances of getting off by hiring a white lawyer. And if you were a white person, you probably weren't inclined to hire a Black lawyer anyway. And so I think Papa probably found himself caught in that and decided that if he was going to support himself and his family, he'd better stick to teaching.
Well, he was a teacher administrator at Allen. For folks who don't know, Allen is associated with the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the church has played a major role, still does, in the school. And you also describe Papa as the best-known Black man that some people loathe.
I think the phrase is the most respected, disliked man.
Okay. All right.
The Black South Carolina of his time.
Why was that?
He, unlike Bishop Chappelle, William David Chappelle, the great-grandfather of the comedian Dave Chappelle, he and Papa were contemporaries. They worked at Allen at the same time, albeit that the bishop was president of the university. Bishop Chappelle knew how to get along with people. He knew how to use people for his own ends. Papa thought if he was right, all he had to do was say, lay out the reasons, and, you know, people would fall in line. And that wasn't true. So he wound up making lots of enemies. You know, that's the reason that he was disliked in South Carolina of his time.
He was very active in church and church politics, and he was leading a movement to have laymen have a bigger voice, and that did not go down well with the clergy, especially the bishop.
That's true. And that's a great example of how Papa thought if he did the right thing, and it's probably important to say the right thing according to his lights, then everything would fall into place. So in 1916, when he was vice president of Allen University, he decided to run for two offices, president of Allen University and editor of the AME Church Review. In its time, under the editorship of Reverdy Ransom, another major AME figure, the AME Church Review is considered, you know, equal to the Crisis of the NAACP Journal. So anyway, Papa puts his hat in the ring to run for editorship of the AME Church Review. But at the same time, at the Church General Conference, he sets up a committee, an organization of lay delegates to ask for more power at the conference. So when the bishops come out, as is their custom, to introduce the members of the committees that are going to run the conference, Papa stands up and says, no, you're not going to do that. We have a committee of laymen here, and we demand that you put laymen on those committees. So the bishops are forced to. But it's not a surprise that he doesn't win the election for editorship of the AME Church Review. And it's not a surprise that when he comes back to Columbia, they choose somebody else to be president of Allen.
What does he do then? At some point, they're going to ask him to leave Allen.
Well, they did. They did. He's not. He doesn't appear on the teaching rolls that fall of 1916. He does whatever he can. He teaches. He teaches for a year or two at the Maysville Institute in Maysville, South Carolina, and he sells insurance. He runs his newspaper. He becomes a notary public, but basically, he and his family are living hand to mouth. That's the bad side. The positive side is that it provides an opportunity for his wife Anna Maria to come into her own. And so Anna Maria goes back to teaching, and then she is hired as supervisor of Richland County's rural colored schools, as those schools were called then.
Those were numerous, generally one-room schools, taught by a single teacher.
Right. And there were about 60 schools that she was responsible for overseeing.
Something I noted that I thought was kind of remarkable, along with taking on those responsibilities, she had to travel. So at the age of 51, she learned to drive.
And I find that utterly amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that she did it at that age is pretty amazing. I mean, we would remark on it if someone did that now. Mm-hmm. But what's even more amazing is that there were so few paved roads around Columbia at that time. The other thing that I found in the research of people who drove at that time complained because the width between the automobile tires was different from the width between mule and horse-drawn wagons that farmers used. And so you were basically navigating these ruts in the unpaved roads outside Columbia.
And let's remind our listeners what this time period is.
Oh, gosh, this is the 1920s.
Yeah. So South Carolina roads, Walter, you know more about this than I do, but they were work in progress is probably an understatement.
And that is not as distant past, as far past as people would think. My wife will tell you, when she was growing up in Columbia in the 1940s, the intersection of Beltline and Trenum Road, from Beltline, Trenum was a dirt road.
Right. Mm-hmm. And for people outside of Columbia, it's right now, that is an intersection that takes you into a whole other section of Columbia, Forest Acres, et cetera. Yeah.
I can't remember the exact phrase, but I found a map, a road map, a state road map. And when I looked on it, so many of the roads that were marked, you know, said something like future planned or, you know, under construction. But it made it very clear that these were not paved roads and you essentially were traveling at your own risk.
She not only came into her own, but she got involved with the Jeans Movement funded by Northern Philanthropists, helped educate teachers. There were Jeans schools because clearly, the funding from the local community, which was Richland County, was minimal, to say the least.
Yeah, and that's one of the sad and unfortunate things that I uncovered. I think the Black schools, the African-American schools, and the African-American teachers were lucky if they received half the salary of white teachers or half the funding that white schools got. And in fact, Mama probably would not have been hired as the supervisor if it had not been for the Jeans Fund, because the Jeans Fund paid half of her salary. And every year when she went back to be reappointed, the Richland County School Board made clear that her appointment was contingent on the Jeans Fund continuing to pay half of her salary.
Can we say something about the Jeans Fund and the Jeans School? First of all, people, that's J-E-A-N-S, right?
J-E-A-N-E-S.
Okay.
And you're going to have to forgive me because I don't have the material in front of me, but Miss or Mrs. Jeans was a Northern woman. I believe she was from Philadelphia. And the Jeans Fund, one of the things the Jeans Fund did was appropriate money for women like Mama supervising teachers. Mama also, and I also find this remarkable, she also oversaw the construction of at least half a dozen schools. And I'm not certain, but I believe those were Rosenwald schools.
Yes. Yes, they are. And Richland County preservationists in the last 5 years have restored at least one Rosenwald school in Richland County.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And there's several more across the state that have been discovered in the 21st century.
Now, right. Rosenwald schools, these were set up by Mr. Rosenwald's foundation?
Mr. Rosenwald, Sears and Roebuck.
Right.
Right. Julius, I think, was his first name.
Yes. And a Rosenwald school, he just didn't give you a blank check. Whatever money he gave had to be matched 50% by the local community.
Ah.
And some of the research, not as pertains Mama's schools, but some of the research I did shows that the Black community was incredibly receptive to these offers and met the challenge in some cases, they raised more money than Mr. Rosenwald or the Rosenwald Fund was going to contribute. So clearly, you know, black folk in this time period, you know, a prominent historian calls this time period between the end of Reconstruction and, say, the 1940s, the nadir of the American Negro status in the country. But clearly, during this very difficult, tragic period, you know, black Americans were interested in education and in contributing to their own welfare.
Well, one of the things that the black community was forced to do was to create their own world separate that had already been kicked out of the general white world, but they created their own world and their own communities. The neighborhood around Allen and Benedict, the Waverly community, which existed as a real community until the 1960s when desegregation, and I was told this by folks who lived there, well, we can now shop downtown at Belk's. We didn't need to shop in the little store around the corner.
Right. And that's a pattern that occurred all over the country. In Washington, D.C., where I grew up, there was a 15 or 16 block street called U Street, which was known in its heyday as a black Broadway. It had several movie theaters. It had, you know, a theater that had live music. And that all kind of went downhill, you know, after integration. But before that, as you say, the Waverly community provided all kinds of opportunities for black South Carolinians, and Papa and Mama were in the thick of it, in addition to her work as the supervisor of schools. Mama was very active in several sororal organizations. And so she and Papa, you know, sort of were among many black Columbians, you know, who helped set the tone for their community.
And you said their house on Lady Street is still there.
It is still there, but unfortunately, it's not in very good shape. And there is no one living there.
Okay. When you started work on your book, all of a sudden you came upon a treasure trove of family records, especially the letters of your great-grandmother, who not only was very, her career is amazing, but she seemed to have a very, I don't want to say a sharp tongue, she recorded the foibles of everybody. You chronicled.
That's true. That's true. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt her.
That's okay.
That's absolutely true. She was sharp-tongued and observant. But I want to go back and kind of correct something that you said. I didn't discover this trove of letter and documents. My mother did. And I have to acknowledge my mother, Ruth Nicholson, because she was in many ways the inspiration for this book. And then the other part of that is that I wrote this book because she couldn't write the book. She was a very smart woman who had gotten a master's degree from the University of Chicago. But when she was in her mid-30s, she had an aneurysm and she had to relearn how to write and speak. And although she made a pretty amazing recovery, it was not to the point where she could have written this book. But she was the one who found these documents. They were in the attic of the house that she had grown up in and the house that she came back to after she had her her stroke. And she immediately recognized the value of these documents. So I could not have written the book without the documents, and I acknowledge that in the book.
Well, you refer to your great-grandparents as Black Victorians.
I do. And by that, I meant that they inherited the values of the black and white educators who came to the South after the end of the war. And, you know, those were values of propriety, sexual abstinence, espousing religion and education, thrift, good manners, all those sorts of things. People have sort of looked askance at me at that phrase, but I think it's an appropriate way of describing them.
in talking about your mother and the book, you start off with an incident when you were still at the Friend School in Washington, a rather disillusioning one, I must say. Would you like to share that?
Yeah, this happened in Thanksgiving of, what would that have been, 1965, which was the first year I was a student at the Sidwell Friend School in Washington, D.C. It is one of the most exclusive private schools in Washington. Up until a year or two before that, it had been largely white. I say largely because there were one or two black students who had been admitted. And then the school decided that it wanted to increase the number of black students. And so I was in the second group of students admitted. That Thanksgiving, the doorbell rang, and it turned out to be one of my white classmates and his family bearing an entire Thanksgiving dinner. They had made the assumption that because I was black, my family must be poor and unable to afford Thanksgiving dinner. Well, that was not true. So we wound up with two Thanksgiving dinners. We knew a family who needed dinner, and so we called them, and the dinner went off to them. But I find it interesting as an example of the ways in which people make assumptions about one another.
Hmm. Well, was that the beginning of your disillusionment? You describe yourself as a disillusioned integrationist.
I said weary integrationist, and that's the title of the introduction to the book. I guess I would not, I would say weary, but not necessarily disillusioned. And part of it, you know, I'm getting here into some issues that may be larger in scope than the book, but part of it, I think, is retaining a certain faith that we are all Americans, and in the end, we're going to do the right thing. I think, I'm not sure if I say this in the book, but I think Papa and Mama had a similar faith. And I say that because if they didn't have faith, then why did they do the things that they did? You know, why did Papa get his degrees? You know, why did Mama get her normal school degree? Why did they send their children to school? I think they had a faith that eventually the country would do the right thing. And my presence at Sidwell Friends, you know, decades later shows, I think, that their faith was justified. So I would say weary, but not disillusioned.
Okay. And that would have been something you could have said about many Black South Carolinians. When World War I came about, they supported the bond drives. Of course, they were all segregated, but they supported the war, and particularly the young men who went overseas. When they came back, they thought that things were going to change, but very quickly that was made clear by the politicians. You quote a poem from the Columbia newspaper, which I think I want to read because it really just made my skin crawl.
Can we put that in context before you start?
Sure.
The poem was written by Mr. Gibbous, Wade Hampton Gibbous, who was a former mayor.
Gibbs.
Oh, Gibbs. Yeah. Okay. So Wade Hampton Gibbs. And he was essentially warning black servicemen that you may have fought overseas, but when you come home, nothing is going to change. You know, you're still going to be members of a subservient class. And Mama wrote a response to his poem. I quote, I think, 5 or 6 lines of Gibbs' poem in the book, and I quote all of Mama's poem in the book. So that's the context.
Prominent politicians of the day, Jimmy Burns was a congressman. He made it quite clear in addresses that, you know, just because you fought overseas, then nothing has changed here. And then the race riots in Charleston were part of a bloody series of race riots all over the country right after the war.
Right, right.
Well, I'm going to read a verse from Mr. Gibbs' poem, which appeared in the state newspaper. And this verse says, "The Negro still the Negro must be. He may fight the hordes of Germany. He may follow his leaders beyond the sea. Yet if in the South he choose to dwell, he must keep to himself and bear him well. No race shall rule the Saxon free." And
wow.
Your grandmother had a response. She initially was going to write a letter to the editor, right?
Well, she did write a letter to the editor, but she doesn't seem to have sent it.
And of course, had she sent it, it would never have appeared in print.
Well, and that would have been for the best, because she was applying for her job as supervisor of rural schools. And, you know, that would have been a reason for them to say no.
Okay.
Well, why don't you read it for us?
Okay. So her response was, "And the slacker spawn be the spawn of hell. The Negro now our brother must be. He has fought the hordes of Germany. He has followed his leaders beyond the sea. And if in the South he still chooses to dwell, we must help him to bear himself up well. One race shall all Americans be."
Hmm. And of course, African Americans living in the South after World War I decided it was time to move elsewhere, the Great Migration. And in South Carolina, African Americans, they followed the railroads up north. And South Carolina in 1922 became a white majority state for the first time since 1820.
Well, yeah, not just New York, though. I mean, if, okay. as you say, following the railroads, I meant Washington, D.C.,
yes.
Philadelphia. And in some cases, folks went further up. There's some members of my family who wound up in Rhode Island. And I don't think we can leave out influence of friends and family. One of the things I talk about in the book is how Mama and Papa's children, only one son wound up staying in South Carolina. The rest followed the railroads, as you say, up north to Washington, Philadelphia, and New York. And when I looked at the census data for their sons who lived in New York, all of the sons either lived with one or another of their family or with other South Carolinians. And so there seemed to have been these networks of people who, you know, advised others about the opportunities up north, and or when people came to cities like New York, you know, help them acclimate, help them figure out how to take the subway, find a church, you know, find lodgings.
Well, and talking about their children, one of their sons wrote a musical with Langston Hughes during the Harlem Renaissance. Another became a dentist, and a daughter earned a doctorate in French. Wow.
Right. Papa's namesake, Caspar Garrett Jr., was the one who wrote the musical that Langston Hughes contributed to. Unfortunately, it was never really produced. It had two tryouts to try to attract backers, but for reasons I was unable to find, it was never produced. I guess the fourth son, Colin, became a dentist and practiced for a time in South Carolina. And then their youngest daughter, Mills, was the one who got the doctorate at Columbia.
Well, you mentioned that two of the children became Pullman porters. What did Mama have to say about that?
She doesn't say anything disparaging about that. She was proud of her sons. Well, actually, let me correct that. If she had had her druthers, they all would have become teachers or other white-collar jobs. And she is a little bit critical of some of them. She wished that they had not left South Carolina, and she was always trying to get them to come back home. But she enjoyed it when her son would come through Columbia, and he would have a little bit of a break, and so they would take food down and they would have a meal together. Also, the difference between that time and now is that being a Pullman porter was a good job. It was a respected occupation. And while it's perhaps not as well known as it should be, the Pullman porters played a role in the civil rights movement and in the dissemination of information from town to town. There were certain newspapers like the Chicago Defender, for example, that were banned in certain places in the South. And the Pullman porters would get bundles of the newspaper and they would take them with them on the train. And then by prearrangement, they would toss them out of the train. And, you know, someone, maybe a farmer, would come by and pick them up. And then he would take charge of distributing the papers in the country. So, yes, I think Mama would have preferred it. She would have liked to have seen her sons and daughters grow up to be teachers and do other kinds of white collar jobs. She was not displeased that two of her sons wound up working as Pullman porters.
David, a follow-up to that in South Carolina. Florence, South Carolina, was a major rail yard, and the porters would bring the newspapers, the Baltimore paper, the Pittsburgh paper, Chicago paper, and local NAACP folks. And the NAACP was better organized in South Carolina before World War II than most people realize. And they would get those newspapers and then distribute them to the black community around the state. Within the black community, one of the places that usually got the Defender would be a barbershop or a beauty shop.
Yes.
So, you know, you were absolutely correct. I mean, it was the African-American world, and they were using the system for themselves.
I hate to say this, gentlemen, but we are getting toward the end of our time. We need to start to wrap up.
All right. David, what would you like people to take away from your book?
I would like people to have a couple of things. One is an appreciation for the strength and courage of many of the people that I write about. I call many of these people unknown black leaders because they weren't well known outside of their communities. But also the number of people who helped create that community. I haven't talked about her, but Matilda Evans was an mm-hmm. example of one of those. Papa and Mama knew her. She was a physician with an interracial clientele. She helped build two hospitals. She built an amusement park for black people. And so I hope people would take away a vision of the past, you know, that includes the effort of stalwart men and women like that.
Well, actually, Dr. Evans' hospital is being restored as we speak.
Oh, that is wonderful.
And that, again, was part of the Waverly community, right across the street from Allen University.
This book is a revelation to people like me, who, born in 1955, grew up in this state, was aware of perhaps, you know, the Waverly community, but had no idea the kind of impact that enclave had and the kind of energy that they they generated. They just generated this amazing, like you say, they had to, but they just generated so much energy and so much good came out of it. It sounds to me like your great-grandparents, the Garretts of Columbia, were shoulder to shoulder with all the people who were making those changes.
I think that's true. Absolutely.
Well, David Nicholson, the author of The Garretts of Columbia, A Black South Carolina Family from Slavery to the Dawn of Integration, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. It was a pleasure meeting David Nicholson and talking about the story of his great-grandparents. The Garretts embraced the hope of America, and they also experienced the melancholy of a family separated by search for opportunity and belonging. With David Nicholson's research and thousands of family letters from which to draw, The Garretts of Columbia is a family history as American history, rich with pivotal events viewed through the lens of the Garretts' lives.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.